right, it's the top of the hour and it's time for obituaries. We have two pages of obituaries for everyone today. First up, from West Des Moines, James R. Talbot, Sr. James R. Talbot, Sr. of West Des Moines, Iowa, went to be with our Savior on November 6, 2021. A celebration of life will be held at New Hope Assembly of God in Urbandale, Iowa, at 11 a.m. on November 11th, 2021. A visitation will begin 1 hour prior to the service. Jim was born to R.E., nickname Bud, and Evelyn Talbot on November 11th, 1937. Jim was married to the love of his life, Karen, for nearly 64 years. To that marriage, 4 children were born: Kathy Jo, James Jr., Pamela, and Sherry. Earlier in life, Jim had various hobbies, including fishing, hunting, spending time outdoors, and making golf clubs. Spending time as a family was very important to him. Jim is survived by his loving and faithful wife, Karen, daughters Julie Woodrin of Burlington, Iowa, Pamela and spouse Steve Wilson of Grimes, Iowa, and Sherry and spouse Reggie Bell of Waukee, Iowa, numerous grandchildren and great-grandchilden. Jim was preceded in death by his parents and 2 children. Memorial contributions may be directed to the family for a future memorial. Online condolences may be made at islescares.com. David Connolly of West Des Moines. David, nicknamed Davy Wayne Connolly, 66, passed away peacefully with his wife by his side on Friday, November 5th, 2021. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. Thursday, November 11th, 2021, at McLaren's Reverendship Chapel in West Des Moines, followed by funeral services at 12 p.m. Burial will be at Jordan Cemetery in West Des Moines. Memorials may be directed to the American Cancer Society of Iowa. Forrest W. Harms of Plymouth. Harms, age 76, of Plymouth, Minnesota, and formerly Des Moines, Iowa, passed away on November 5, 2021. He was a former executive director of the Des Moines Area Religious Council from 1990 to 2007. Memorial service at 11 a.m. Saturday, November 13th, with visitation 1 hour prior to Our Savior's Reformed Church, address 8209 Zane Avenue North, Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. There's more information at, I'm not too sure how to say it, so I'll spell it here, at www.kozlakradulovich.com. under A Celebration of Life. Dwayne E. Sabin of Urbandale. Dwayne E. Sabin, 83, died Friday, November 5th, 2021, at his home in Urbandale, surrounded by his loving family. The family will receive friends from 5 to 7:30 p.m. Friday, November 12th, at Isles Westover Chapel. A private family funeral service will be held Saturday at St. Stephen's Lutheran Church. Burial will take place at Mason City Memorial Gardens. Dwayne was born December 25th, a Christmas baby, that's nice, December 25th, 1937, in Bryslin, Minnesota, to Arthur and Liza Sabin. He grew up in Manly, Iowa, and graduated from Manly High School. Dwayne went to work for Rock Island Railroad, Chicago Northwestern, and retired from Pacific Union after 42 years of service. He enjoyed fishing, hunting, golf, boating, and poker games with his family and friends, especially loved spending time with his family. Dwayne also enjoyed an occasional trip to the casinos. Survivors include his loving wife of 61 years, Sharon Sabin, children Sean and spouse Paul Bernards Sabin of Waukee, Iowa, Brad and spouse Susan Sabin of Clear Lake, Shannon and spouse Brent Carlson of Clive, grandchildren Casey Peterson of Ely, Austin Sabin of Beaverdale, Emma Carlson, Beau Carlson, Steve Carlson, all of Clive, great-grandchildren Graham, Benny, Crew, Marlowe, and his siblings Gloria Reindl, David Sabin, Mark Sabin, Daniel Sabin, sister-in-law Margaret Sabin, brother-in-law Robert Brickholz, many nieces and nephews. Dwayne was preceded in death by his parents, his brother Paul Sabin, and sister-in-law Barbara Brickholz. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to Blank Children's Developmental Center under the direction of Dr. Nate Noble, Unity Point, or Care Initiatives Hospice. And you can read more of his obituary and condolences at islescares.com. Diane?
All right, continuing on with our obituaries, our next one is for James Erb. James Erb, 80, of Charles City, passed away on Friday, November 5th. A funeral mass for Jim Erb will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, November 12th, at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Charles City, with Father Tom Heathershaw officiating. Interment will be at a later date at St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery in Roseville. Friends may call from 5 to 8 p.m. on Thursday, November 11th at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church, located at 106 Chapel Lane in Charles City. Visitation will continue 1 hour prior to Mass on Friday. James Andrew Erb was born December 7th, 1940 in Rockford, Iowa, the son of Paul and Rose Erb. Raised on the family farm in Rockford, Jim attended Ulster No. 8 one-room school until 8th grade, then continued his education at Charles City High School and was the 1959 valedictorian. He attended the University of Iowa, graduating in 1963 with the highest distinction, with a BA in political science. Jim continued his studies at Yale Law School and received a JD in 1966. He enlisted in the Air Force and served from 1966 to 1971 in Air Force Intelligence and the Judge Advocate General Corps, obtaining the rank of captain. On August 16, 1969, Jim was united in marriage to Marianne Ackerman in Tier, Germany, while stationed overseas. They had three children, Elizabeth, Paul, and Joseph. They were married for 39 years until Marianne's passing in 2009. After leaving military service, Jim and Marianne moved to Charles City, and Jim joined the Frey and McCartney law firm in 1972, where he continued as partner until his death. Jim served one term as Floyd County attorney in 1973. Jim later met Cheryl Erb, and they were married on December 30th, 2011, at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Charles City. Democratic politics were important to Jim, and he made two unsuccessful runs for state legislature in 1990 and 1994, before successfully running for mayor. Jim served as mayor of Charles City for 22 years, from 1996 to 2017, and was involved in many projects during his tenure, including construction of the first whitewater course in Iowa, recovery efforts after flooding events, and the establishment of TIF districts for the community. Jim became mayor shortly after the Oliver White Farm Tractor Factory had permanently closed, and helped set the course for the community to recover and eventually thrive economically. Jim also served on the Iowa League of Cities Executive Board from 2013 to 2017, serving as board president from 2016 to 2017. Throughout his legal and political careers, Jim was well known for being a gentleman and for his talents in mediation and bringing groups together. Jim used his skills to serve numerous county and state bar association committees, civic and nonprofit committees, and governmental boards as member chairman and director. Jim was focused on creating or working through regional and joint entities to solve a number of issues he was passionate about, including watershed management and economic development. Jim continued to be heavily engaged in causes until his death and was involved in the recent efforts that resulted in Charles City being recognized as an AARP livable community in 2021. Always active in the community, Jim was a member of a number of community organizations, including Immaculate Conception Catholic Church, Knights of Columbus, Elks, Kiwanis, Charles City Chamber of Commerce, Ambassadors, American Legion, and the VFW. Due to his continued dedication and efforts, Jim has been honored with numerous awards over the years, including being inducted into the Charles City Excellence in Education Foundation's Hall of Fame in 2013, Charles City Man of the Year in 2015, named to the Iowa League of Cities Hall of Fame in 2019, and received the Iowa Rural Hero Award by the Iowa Rural Development Council in 2021. Jim will be remembered and missed by many for his passion and commitment to the community. But for Jim's family and close friends, he will be remembered for his endless support, compassion, unique sense of humor, and love of his family, especially his grandchildren. Jim loved to socialize and thoroughly enjoyed his gourmet dinner group and had a love for travel that began at a young age when his parents took him to Germany for 3 weeks to visit family. This love only grew throughout life, and he especially enjoyed Rhodes Scholars trips in recent years. Jim thoroughly enjoyed sports in a way that was unique to his style of bringing people together, supporting all Iowa teams. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Charles City YMCA Foundation, or TLC, the Learning Center, in Charles City, in honor of Jim. Our next obituary is for Marcia Jean Harris from Panora. Marcia Jean Harris, 87, passed away Wednesday, November 3rd, surrounded by family and friends at the Guthrie County Hospital in Guthrie Center, Iowa. Marcia was born on September 8, 1934, in Des Moines, to Raymond Samuel and Gladys Ruper. She married William Harris of Elkhart, Iowa, on June 18, 1954. Marcia enjoyed playing golf, bridge, traveling, and watching all types of sports. She also enjoyed sharing a glass of beer or wine with good friends. Also known as the Sassy Bear Lady, she collected all types of bears from all over the world, many gifted from friends and family. Marcia was also a longtime Chicago Cubs fan who lived long enough to see them win the World Series in 2016, which she was grateful for. Marcia was preceded in death by her husband of 54 years, Bill Harris. A celebration of life will be held on Saturday, November 13th at the Lake Panora Conference Center from 2 to 4 p.m. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the First Presbyterian Church in Guthrie Center, Iowa. And our next obituary is for Max Eden. Max Eden, age 27, passed away on Wednesday, November 3rd. Max had a kind soul and loved his little family, Amanda and Lynn, and his extended family and many, many wonderful friends. He was born August 16, 1994. He was raised in Des Moines by his dad, Joshua Eden, and his mom, Christina Dawson, and his grandparents, Rosemary and Steve Eden. Max graduated in 2012 from Valley High School in West Des Moines. Throughout his school years, he gained many friends, including classmates and teachers. It was at Valley he met his future wife, Amanda Witten. Max and Amanda were married June 17, 2017. They welcomed their daughter, Lynn Kennedy Eden, on April 17, 2019. His favorite football team was the Kansas City Chiefs, and he enjoyed watching games with his mother and attending them at Arrowhead Stadium. Max enjoyed camping with his family and his wife. He loved taking risks and being the life of the party. He drooled over older Chevy vehicles and enjoyed working on vehicles. He enjoyed getting his hands dirty and helping in any way he could with projects around the house. He couldn't go anywhere without running into someone he knew. We will all greatly miss him. Our shining light is gone, but we know we'll be together someday. And our next obituary is for Victor Meek. Victor Philip Meek went to be with the Lord on November 2nd, 2021. Phil was born in Des Moines and resided there for most of his adult life. After attending North High School, he entered the United States Marine Corps in 1946, serving in Guam and Hawaii. After returning home, he attended Tech Vocab to become a skilled laborer. He worked at Solar Aircraft, and after its closure, John Deere hired him to work in the Research and Development Department until his retirement in 1986. After work hours, he began his own business, siding, roofing, remodeling, and building additions to homes. In 1948, he married his sweetheart, Teresa McGreen, and brought six children into the world. After Teresa passed away, he married Patricia Johns in 1998 and spent his retirement years in St. Augustine, Florida. Victor attended First Baptist Church of Jacksonville. Two of his earthly loves were watching the Jacksonville Jaguars playing Rook, often hiding behind the Rook. A viewing will be held at Craig's Funeral Home in St. Augustine, Florida on Friday, November 5th from 5 to 7 p.m. Final services are tentatively scheduled for the 10th of November with visitation at 10 a.m. followed by services at 12 p.m. at Hamilton's Funeral Home near Highland Park Memory Gardens in Des Moines, Iowa. He will be interred at Glendale Cemetery with military honors. And our final obituary is for Neil Smith. Neil Edward Smith was born March 23, 1920, and died November 2, 2021. In his over 101 years, he lived a remarkable life. He was the third child of James and Margaret Smith, following older siblings Kenneth and Mildred. He grew up on a farm near Packwood, Iowa. He loved nature and the outdoors, and later he would share that love with the people of Iowa. He attended a one-room schoolhouse where he often listened to the older students' lessons, and his penchant for learning took him many places and never stopped. He lived through the Depression and found creative ways to raise income. Beginning as a teenager, he managed farms for nearby farmers, owning a gas station, and offered dances at the Packwood Community Center. He enlisted in the Army after the bombing of Pearl Harbor and was called up on his birthday in 1942. He served in the Army Air Corps as a pilot of a B-24 in the South Pacific. He was shot down twice during his tour of duty and was awarded the Purple Heart, 9 battle stars, and the Air Medal with 4 oak leaf clusters. After the war, he returned to Iowa and married his wife of 70 years, Beatrix Heavens, who he considered to be his partner in all his life endeavors. Neil took advantage of the GI Bill. He attended the University of Missouri for 1 year before transferring to Syracuse University in New York. Neil, Bee, and son Doug returned to Iowa, where Neil and Bee attended Drake University Law School, both graduating in 1950. In keeping with his belief in women's rights, Neil and Bee went into law practice together. However, Neil's interest in politics soon became his primary focus. He was elected national president of the Young Democratic Clubs of America in 1953. In 1958, he was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives from Iowa and served there for 36 years. During his tenure in Congress, he served on many committees, including government operations, education and labor, and appropriations. He chaired the Select Committee on Small Business, the Appropriations Subcommittee on Justice, Commerce and State, and the Appropriations Subcommittee on Health and Human Services. He authored the Anti-Nepotism Bill, the Wholesome Meat Act, the Commodity Future Trading Act, the Economic Opportunity Act, as well as co-writing and sponsoring other legislation. His love of nature influenced him to shepherd authorization appropriations for Red Rock, Sailorville, and Rathbun Dams so families could enjoy recreation together. In addition, he sponsored creation of what is now the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge and Prairie Learning Center and trails and green spaces established around central Iowa. He worked closely with both Democratic and Republican members of Congress, Iowa governors, and other Iowa leaders to promote economic, social, and recreational interests of Iowans. Currently, the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge, the Neil Smith Federal Building, the Neil Smith Trail, and the Neil and B. Smith Law Clinic all bear his name. He was often writing, including personal poetry and books, including Mr. Smith Went to Washington, From Eisenhower to Clinton, Hanging Out in Burr Oak, and in 2019, From My Century to Yours, Wisdom from the Near 100-Year Life of a former Congressman, Neil Edward Smith. Neil was also a family man. He enjoyed attending his son Doug's and daughter Sharon's school events and was a generous and loving grandfather. Although quiet, especially for a politician, he had a sense of humor and enjoyed the company of good friends. He stayed active in many civic organizations up until the pandemic limited his ability to interact with others. The family would like to thank Scottish Rite Park for the excellent personal care that Neil received from all the staff while living there. In lieu of flowers, the family would request that contributions be made to the Friends of Neil Smith Wildlife Refuge, Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation, or the Iowa Legal Aid Equal Justice. Private family service will be held at 10 a.m. Wednesday, November 10th, followed by burial at Prairie Center Cemetery in Packwood, Iowa. Funeral service will be live streamed, and friends are encouraged to join the family virtually through the link at his obituary at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. And that concludes our obituary reading for this morning. Maddie, I'm going to hand it back to you.
Wonderful. All right, and we're heading into sports now since it's just about that time. And up first, everyone's favorite, football. Evaluating performance of Padilla Evans' big day. This is from columnist Chad Listicow of the Des Moines Register. Upon further review, I'm able to confirm that Iowa delivered a good, solid win Saturday at Northwestern. While there were a few worrisome moments late, the Hawkeyes improved to 7-2 overall and were ranked number 14th in Sunday's coaches' poll with every meaningful home game on deck against Minnesota, which will be at 2:30 p.m. on the Big Ten Network, and Illinois at 1 p.m. on Fox Sports 1. For those wondering, head coach Kirk Ferentz answered why he got ultra-conservative on offense with a double-digit lead in the fourth quarter. Then again, with three straight runs and a punt with a 5-point lead with just over 2 minutes to go. Why not throw it? We were confident the defense would be able to hold him, Ferentz said afterwards. He was right, as Dane Bolton's interception sealed a 17-12 win that was highlighted by a quarterback change. It's there, of course, that we start with this week's DVR Monday, even though it's Tuesday, putting more scrutiny on new starter Alex Padilla's relief appearance. The redshirt sophomore from Greenwood Hills, Colorado, was listed as the number one quarterback on Monday's depth chart, signaling more significant action ahead. When he reviewed his film with coaches Sunday, there is a sampling of what he saw. Here's a sampling of what he saw. The success on over-the-middle throws was something to build on. Quick slants and crossing routines gave Padilla's quick-release style opportunities for Hawkeye wide receivers to gain yards after the catch. Padilla was 7-for-10 for 90 yards on the middle throws, and he should have been 8-for-10 for the at least 115, if not for Charlie Jones having a perfect throw go right through his hands in the fourth quarter on 2nd and 13. His best throw of the day? While the 26-yarder to Keegan Johnson on his third attempt was gorgeous, a 10-yard late in the first half to Johnson showed why Padilla has the tools and confidence to make his first start against Minnesota. With 2 minutes and 2 seconds left in the first half from his own 11-yard line, Padilla rolled out on play action, one of the few times Iowa let him throw on the move, and gunned a perfect strike to a well-covered Johnson on the right sideline for a first down. On a related note, on third quarter rollout, Tracy was open in the flat, but Padilla went with the more aggressive throw over the middle to Arland Bruce IV and completed it for 12 yards. That began Iowa's field goal drive. Padilla's small sample size knack for taking the most that the defensive give, not just the safest play, was another encouraging step. More touch on-screen passes was needed. Padilla brought too much mustard on a first quarter swing pass to Tyrone Tracy Jr. and a second quarter screen attempt to Gavin Williams. Probably just some excitement, Padilla admitted, having nerves and a lack of experience. Padilla also looked a little indecisive in his one true scramble of the day and 30 drop backs. He rolled left on a 3rd and 5 from Northwestern's 43 in the third quarter and looked like he couldn't decide whether to run or pass. Once he chose pass, it was too late and off balance, even though Johnson was open at a first down. Overall, it was a good day. Pro Football Focus gave Padilla a grade of 71.7, which was the 6th highest on Iowa's offense. Spencer Petras has had 4 games graded higher than that this season. Any guess on Iowa's top graded player on defense Saturday? And he was number 2 overall to center Tyler Lieberman, of course. If you said backup defensive and Joe Evans, grab yourself a Kit Kat from the kids' Halloween candy stash. Evans received the highest grade from PFF against the run and pass by a wide margin among Iowa's defensive linemen. No surprise, then, that Evans was on the field for all 3 of Iowa's sacks of Mobile Northwestern quarterback Andrew Marty. On Northwestern's second drive of the game, his powerful rush off the left and helped blow up a screen play that ended up seeing Noah Shannon spin Marty down for a 12-yard sack. Time and again, Evans seemed to torpedo Northwestern momentum. He was credited with 2 quarterback hurries and 1 sack for 8 yards, but he was robbed of another tackle for loss in the stats on a -8-yard run by receiver Raymond Nero III, who basically went to the ground as Evans had completely read the play. Evans should have had another third quarterback hurry when he sniffed out a double reverse pass in a 17-6 game in the fourth quarter. Marty lined up on the left as a wide receiver and took a pitch in the pocket. Marty could only change direction and throw the ball away incomplete. Because Marty didn't start the play as the quarterback, it wasn't credited as a hurry. Evans logged 48 snaps among all defensive linemen to Zach Van Valkenburg, number 61. The 6'2", 248-pound former walk-on from Ames is morphing into a dominant defensive end before our eyes. A few other observations about the defense. Iowa unveiled a 3-3-5 wrinkle on at least 4 third down tries for Northwestern in the first half. Iowa used 3 down linemen, including Van Winkelberg, Evans, and John Wagoner, and kept third linebacker Justin Jacobs on the field. Jacob blitzed the first time it was used. Seth Benson and Jack Campbell blitzed this next time. It is a smart way to keep Jacobs on the field more often. Yeah, there was bad tackling. If Campbell is part of Tuesday's media availability, he would be the first to tell you he had a few rough moments on Ryan Field grass. But he wasn't alone. It was a team-wide issue. Credit Northwestern running back Evan Hall, 6 catches, 89 yards, including 2 gains of 31 on the Wildcats' lone touchdown drive, for being a really good player, too. That was the biggest reason I saw that Northwestern averaged 2.56 yards on its first 41 plays and 7.59 on their final 34. Sometimes missing tackles indicate tired legs, and maybe if Iowa had converted more third downs on offense in the second half, the defense wouldn't have been grassed. looking into Iowa's third down struggles. Northwestern entered the game as one of the worst third down defensives in the Big Ten, but held Iowa to a 2-for-14 for the game. The first three were when Petras was at quarterback. Then Iowa converted two of its first three with Padilla, including on a sweet 19-yard throw to Tyler Goodson. But that happened as Iowa missed its last eight third down tries. Well, that last one was a kneel down, so throw that out. On a 3rd-and-6 deep shot early in the third quarter, Jones was blatantly held by his cornerback, but there was no call. Padilla's ball might have been on target for a touchdown if not for that full jersey tug. Bad break for Iowa there. Mostly, there were some ultra-conservative calls, like a 3rd-and-9 run from Northwestern's 10-yard line, or the 3rd-and-5 run from Northwestern's 38 in the fourth. That was more Kurt Ferentz than Brian. This was a game the head coach wanted to play it safe with an 11 or 14 point lead. But next game, the coaches will have to put more trust in their own quarterback. Some shout-outs. Good recovery, guys. The jarring blocked punt on Troy Taylor's attempt late in the first half probably should have been returned for a touchdown by Nero. The Northwestern receiver blocked the kick at the 32-yard line, then scooped the loose ball at Iowa 16. But credit great hustle by the three Iowa Hawkeye walk-ons, linebackers Mike Timm and Kyle Frazier, and fullback Turner Palisard for hustling back on the play. Timm took a nice angle in anticipation of cutting Nero off around the 10, but Palisard got him from behind. Instead of 7 points, Northwestern had to settle for 3 of the blocked kick after having first and goal from 9. Welcome back in full, Kyler shot. The early August broken foot from a jump off hay bales made national headlines. Shot's slow recovery has been less of a major storyline, but significant. Finally, for the first time, he played every offensive snap Saturday and left guard, and he was great. He and Linderbaum were instrumental on most of Goodson's big runs, including the 13-yard touch and back-to-back totes of 15 and 22 in the first quarter. Shot's full return should help an embattled offensive line as November football continues. That stopped two-point conversion was big. Credit to Benson, Jamari Harris, and Jack Croner for tracking tight end Jackson Freakus into the end zone on a reverse pass. And credit Evans again for reading the play on the edge of hurrying the throw of receiver Malik Washington. The play had no chance thanks to disciplining defense. That stop with 2 minutes and 15 seconds to go ensured that Northwestern would need a touchdown to extend or win the game, not a field goal. Diane?
All right, thank you. We're going to go to our next big sports article, because if you're not watching football, maybe you're outdoors deer hunting. This article is entitled, Patterning a Rutting Buck is Like a Jigsaw Puzzle, One Piece at a Time. A big buck and his rut routine is pieced together using the same sequence of deliberation that we use to piece together a puzzle. If you do your homework as a hunter, it is possible to put together a big buck's pattern, piece by piece, until you are standing over that buck filling out your transportation tag. Here is my sequence to building a big buck jigsaw during the rut. All puzzles are most easily started by piecing together the edges until you have formed the perimeter of the picture. The same applies to the bruiser you are chasing in the woods this fall. You know a deer is in your area because you've seen him. You just need to nail down the core area of where he lives. The size of a buck's territory depends on two things. the size of his ego, and the deer's age. Young deer will have the largest territory during the rut. A 1 to 3 year old buck is likely to have a large home range during the rut because he can be anywhere a doe will pull him to 1 minute and then get in a backwoods bar fight the next and be on his way to the next farm to search for an easier doe. Middle-aged deer will have a medium-sized range during the early season and pre-rut, but this area will shrink as the rut kicks into full swing. 3 to 5 year old bucks are your more aggressive fighters that won't stop until they have a dominant hold on a home range for the year. Once they have run other bucks off, they pin themselves down to enjoy the fruits of their early season labor. 5 to 9 year old bucks tend to have the smallest territory because they are large enough to void off most contenders, and they're smart enough to know that does who aren't ready to breed don't need to be chased for miles until they change their mind. A big buck's territory can literally be as small as 10 acres, while a young buck's territory can be as large as a mile or more if he's getting the short end of every stick in the woods. Once you have the edge pieces in place, it's time to start looking for common denominators in the other pieces as you begin to complete your big buck puzzle. The bulk of any puzzle is trying to decide if the piece we are looking at goes in one of several parts of the final picture. Not only do we need to look at the natural factors like habitat, food, and does, but we need to look at movement patterns charged by supernatural factors like moon phases, weather patterns, and pressures. Camera trails are awesome tools that can give us more information now regarding the patterns of your buck than they once did. They show you the time of day or night he moved, the barometric pressure, the moon phase, and more, depending on the model of cam you use. The time of day is only one piece of the puzzle, but more than likely he is only moving at that time because of the other factors that align at that time. Make a list of all the factors you know when reviewing trail cam pics, as these will tell you when you have the best chance of him replicating his actions and you can plan to be in the woods. Now that we are narrowing in on the center, we need to look at the animate and inanimate objects in the picture. If you have hunted an area before, you likely know the funnels that guide the deer through their habitat. Whether this is a simple draw up the middle of a food source, a waterway, or simply a depression in the pasture, big bucks will still use these to move their does around during the rut. Often the bucks will hang back and use the simple inanimate objects or land features to mask their presence until the doe is hot and ready for action. If you know the buck is in his home range and the does are funneling through the specific land features, use these to target likely buck hideouts during the hot rut action. Finally, we need to consider basic biological and ecological factors that will paint the final touches to our nearly completed picture of where the buck will be. After a hard day of chasing, a buck will be ready to eat, bed, or travel. Even though he has these biological needs, he isn't a complete idiot to forget about the ecological role we play as hunters. He will still feel vulnerable in the open when he isn't chasing. So when planning your hunts around his core area, your best bet is to only move in if you feel that it is the perfect time to kill him. It is vital that you know all the factors that contribute to his movements: moon phases and weather pressures, doe movement patterns throughout his area, key land features that will guide his movements, and the ecological pressures you have or have not put on him will all be needed to figure out what your key moments are. You are the final piece of the puzzle. If you try to place yourself into the picture before the time is right, the bigger chance of you distorting your puzzle by alarming him to your presence. Wait until the other pieces are all in place, and then make your move to put the masterpiece on your wall. This article was provided to the Register courtesy of the Iowa Sportsman magazine. And the author of this article was Aaron Stonehocker. All right, and Maddie, I'll turn it over to you.
All right, I'm going to switch over to the Iowa Life section. They have a review of a new restaurant here titled Parlor. Detroit-style pizza joint opens in Beaverdale. This comes from Ellie Wingnall. There's no such thing as too much pizza. and a unique new option has joined the Des Moines pie slinging scene. Beaverdale's newest restaurant, Parlor, opened Friday at 4041 Urbandale Avenue, formerly home to Saints Pub and Patio. A project of Jason Simon, owner of Eatery A and Alba, Parlor's menu features specialty Detroit-style pizzas, homemade grilled sausage, and plenty of shareables. The centerpiece bar features around 20 beers on tap, wine and sangria, and a playful cocktail menu. The kitchen is led by Chef Joe Kuzomavic, the former sous chef of Eatery A, while the front of house is in the hands of General Manager Ben Norris, who has worked with Simmons Restaurants for several years. If I can turn the page here, there we go. About an inch thick with focaccia-like crust, Parlor's pizza bake in a 14 by 10 inch pan and weighs about 2.5 pounds. Cheese spreads to the edge of the pan, resulting in a crust coated with a crunchy layer while the center stays soft and chewy. The pizzas are priced at $16.50 per pan and generously feed two or three, more with appetizers like spicy meatballs and pepperoni fries. It's cut into six large and easy-to-hold squares, each getting their fair amount of crunchy edge. The adventurous, non-traditional topping combinations that Eatery A Woodfire Pizzas are known to make and make an appearance here, too. Jump in the line as the red sauce pie with pulled pork, adobo, and mango jalapeno salsa. The sausadu is a fully vegan option with vegan chorizo, feta, pickled vegetables, and chimichurri. The Here You Come Again is a classic that will satisfy even the pickiest eater with a deeply flavored red sauce, pepperoni, capricola, sausage, and Marguerite sauce. We do the pizzas in the same spirit as Eatery A. We'll have the traditional pepperoni on there, but a lot of them are their own little magic play on themselves, Simon said. If you sense a pattern in naming convention, you're correct. The pizzas bear names of timeless hits from decades past, as do the cocktails. It gives my guys in the kitchen a little bit of fun when they actually make the pizzas or they get a special going. They have to come up with a name for an old-timey song for it, Simon said. Eatery A's executive chef, Keith Johnson, helped create the airy, chewy dough. There's also a gluten-free option, which was specifically developed and, according to Simon, is rockin'. Diners can choose from classic cocktails or specialty parlor cocktails, like the not-too-sweet House of the Rising Sun with bourbon, Clamato, and Aperol, or the lip-puckering South Bend Suarez featuring Tito Vodka, lemon, Cucuri Aperito, and mint. Happy hour runs from 2 to 5 daily, during which patrons can enjoy half-price tap beers and sangria along with pizza slices. Simon and his team began renovating the space in March, and both inside and outside received a major facelift. In fact, the location choice was inspired by the opportunity to refurbish an old building, Simon said. It's a task he's familiar with. Eatery A's Mediterranean Fair is served in a former Blockbuster video store, and Alba's fine dining experience takes place in that what once was a Ford dealership. In addition to Eatery A and Alba, Simon's influence extends to both Harbinger and Motley School Tavern, which he helped Joe, Tip, and Nick Ganwa establish respectively. Simon took the parlor remodel in a unique direction, painting the walls a bright shade of green, and then some of the space's earliest visitors questioning his decision-making. But paired with large black and white framed prints of music legends like The Who and Ray Charles, the overall effect is modern and jazzy. On the opposite side of the dining room is what Simon refers to as the Bumblebee Wall, which incorporates leftover portions of Japanese distressed wood that was used to remodel the building's outside. The original bar in the center of the dining room has an updated look and dimension. The dining space is lined with new booths and high tops dot the open floor plan atop funky area rugs near two shuffleboard games. Glass panel garage doors allow light to stream in, and in the warm months will open to the patio. Parlor will be open from 2 to 11 p.m. Wednesday and Thursday, 11 a.m. midnight Friday and Saturday, and 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. on Sunday. Diane?
All right. Thank you, Maddie. I'm going to do another food-based article. How breakfast can help with blood sugar control. If you continuously find yourself confusing breakfast foods with your favorite frosting-topped desserts, then this may be your wake-up call, especially if you're pre-diabetic or diabetic. Sure, it's important to eat something for breakfast, but that doesn't mean to use this motto as your excuse to eat donuts or other sugar bomb bakery items instead of a balanced breakfast. To keep blood sugar spikes and crashes at bay, let's find out the right type of foods that are to rise and shine and dominate each day. Choose complex carbs. Bakery items can make your blood sugar skyrocket. Yet, so does the bowl of sugar you pour from your favorite box of cereal. Rather than these refined grains, opt for their whole wheat counterparts, like oatmeal, waffles, or toast made from whole wheat flour. These options are full of fiber, which takes longer to digest and affects your blood sugar more slowly. Find the good fats. Unfortunately, people with diabetes are at a higher risk for elevated cholesterol. Therefore, eating heart-healthy fats such as avocado and olive oil can help lower bad cholesterol. Avocado toast, anyone? Focus on fiber. Rather than thinking about the foods you should limit, turn your focus to foods that include more fiber. Nearly 95% of Americans don't get enough of this nutrient, and those with diabetes should be prioritizing it at each meal and snack. Fiber helps control your appetite as well as your blood sugars. The recommended amount of fiber is about 25 to 35 grams per day. Don't avoid fruit, but skip the juice. Let's clear the air. You can eat fruit as a diabetic. The sugar found in fruit doesn't mean high blood sugar spikes. In fact, a serving of this naturally sweet stuff provides the same amount of carbs as a cup of milk or a slice of bread. The caveat to the fruit rule is to select the whole fruit form rather than the juice. Say goodbye to all that filling fiber when it's pure liquid. Here's the thing. Everyone's diabetic care plan is different, but one thing we can all benefit from is eating a good breakfast. If you want to learn more about your current blood sugars, consider attending the Hy-Vee Dietitian's free A1C screening tour. This tour is taking place at more than 40 stores during November. Screenings take between 5 to 10 minutes and will provide you with your A1C reading, which is a measure of your average blood glucose over the past 3 months. Appointments are given on a first-come, first-served basis, and you can register for this at Hy-Vee.com. All right.
All right. With that, I'll start in on Dear Abby. Wife is taking over the whole home with her remote work. Dear Abby, my wife works from home and we're having a disagreement about the home workspace. She says I interrupt her too much and shouldn't talk to her so often. While I agree with that, I don't agree with her roaming around the house with her laptop while she's in meetings. If I turn on the TV, listen to music, or talk on the phone, she gets upset. I've been digging my heels in, saying I'm entitled to enjoy my own home, and she should either stay in her home office or go to a coffee shop. To me, what she's doing is like taking your laptop into the work break room and telling people to be quiet because she's in a meeting. I know her job is stressful, and she gets anxious So now I'm torn. Am I unrealistic to accept her not to make our entire house our office? From Walking on Eggshells. Dear Walking, people create home offices for a reason. It's a designated, organized place to work. Your wife should not be roaming the house with her laptop and insisting you maintain complete silence. Ideally, some physical boundaries should be set that equitably divide the house between her office and the rest of the house. Another suggestion might be for you to find some activity away from your home a couple of mornings or afternoons a week, a part-time job, a sport, or volunteering while she is busy in meetings. Dear Abby, should aging parents have to pay their children to take them to appointments or elsewhere? Wondering parent. Dear wondering parent, I'm guessing you and your spouse did plenty of chauffeuring before your children had driver's license. The child who suggested it should be ashamed of themselves. That was Dear Abby, and it is written by Abigail Van Buren, also known as Janine Phillips, and was founded by her mother, Pauline Phillips. You can always write Dear Abby online at dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069. And that concludes the reading of the Des Moines Register for Tuesday, November 9th, 2021. I've been Maddie Ryan, and my partner at the microphone has been Diane McElroy. Earlier, you heard our wonderful Tuesday first shift readers of Deanna Snyder, whew, and Pat Steele. You can access IRIS programs on any computer, smartphone, mobile device, or smart speaker like the Amazon Echo or Google Home. If you would like to learn more, just give us a call at 243-6833 or toll free anywhere in Iowa at 1-877-404-4747 or check out our website, iowaradioreading.org. A special thank you to our broadcast partners, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and our music partner, bensound.com. And most of all, thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service. And have a great rest of your Tuesday.